Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to stream our television show, get our recipes, or take our free online cooking classes. Enjoy the show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball.
You know, people who don't know me very well, who have actually witnessed me eat, become very shocked about this. I don't do this for sport. You know, I take this very seriously, and at the risk of harming my body in future decades to come.
Chef Edward Lee traveled to 16 cities to explore the underbelly of American food, and he ate a lot. Bad chicken Kiev in Brighton Beach and excellent skeeter dogs in West Virginia. By the way, his new book is called Buttermilk Graffiti. But first, I chat with Kim Severson of the New York Times about her article, Finding a Lost Strain of Rice and Clues to Slave Cooking. Kim Severson, how are you?
Great. How are you, Chris?
Great. Nice to have you back on the show. This is a story about rice. You wrote in the New York Times a while back, a lost strain of rice, an upland rice. So let's just start. What is rice and how is upland rice different than regular rice?
Well, there's the rice that grows that we sort of imagine in that needs is very water intensive, and so it grows with flooding fields. The rice gets planted underwater. It grows. It gets harvested with people who are mucking around in water. So you have a kind of a rice that grows in a very water intensive way, which is the rice that much of the South was built on in the Carolinas in particular. So you had this Carolina gold rice that was, you know, it was beautiful, sent to New York, sent all over. It was really quite lucrative for growers and plantation owners in the South. But there's also something called uplands rice, which is kind of a dry cultivation rice. And it's the hull is a little thicker, and it's a different kind of a rice than what you would find from that creamy Carolina gold rice. So uplands rice is something essentially you could grow in your back garden patch if you wanted to without having to build a dike and flood it.
So there's obviously a cultural context here with the Gullah culture. Could you explain what that is?
So the Gullah Geechee culture were essentially West African slaves who were brought over and settled in the part of South Carolina, North Carolina, a little bit down into Florida on the coast. And the Gullah Geechee culture has very specific ties to places in West Africa. And particularly after malaria and a number of other diseases and also economic and political forces had slave owners abandoning some of the sea islands on the coast of Southeast America. A lot of the African slaves were left there by themselves, essentially, and so they kept their culture very intact, and they survived. And the Gullah Geechee culture is sort of the last intact, very pure link to African culture in America. In fact, back in the day, being called a Geechee was considered kind of a slur, particularly among African Americans who were from the city, and it's kind of a way to say that folks were kind of country if they were a Geechee. And so there's been a big reclamation of that term and of that culture as of late.
So why were people looking for this rice, which no longer existed as far as anyone knew anywhere in the world?
Well, for a long time, the question of whether or not Africans brought rice with them and their skills at rice growing when they were enslaved and brought to America was a question among historians. Certainly, there was a line of thinking that the people who were selected to be slaves and captured were selected for their rice growing knowledge and brought to America and used for that purpose. So finding rice that actually came from Africa became a great quest for a lot of people. And Judith Carney, who was a great rice historian from the University of California, made this discovery of rice in Suriname, which is a South American country. And she found a group of people descended from escaped slaves who had gone up into the mountains. And she found this particular kind of rice and these kinds of cooking methods that linked it directly to West Africa. So that Suriname discovery was kind of considered the gold standard that actually did prove that Africans had agency in this particular kind of rice economy. And then through almost a serendipitous meeting, some rice scholars discovered this other strain of rice growing in Trinidad, which is what I stumbled onto and discovered this great detective tale.
So let's talk about how the rice got from the Carolina coast to Trinidad. And that has something to do with the War of 1812, I believe, right?
Yes, you know your history, sir. So in the War of 1812, the Brits went to some of the enslaved Africans and said, here's the deal. If you come fight against the Americans, against the people who are essentially your oppressors, we will give you some land and some freedom. So a group of people from South Georgia agreed that happened, and then they were taken to Trinidad and given a certain section of land. Now, the Brits at that time had a lot of undeveloped parts of Trinidad, and so the place that they put them in the hill country, and I think the idea was that they would help develop this. So they took some of this uplands rice, and they started growing it. And this group of people are called Merikans, and it is a derivative of the word America, the Americans. So they're Merikans, starting with an M.
So this rice was actually genetically tested, and it turns out it was in West Africa, but originally it was a Japonica rice, right?
Correct. So there was a bit of a lot of excitement when they first discovered this rice because they thought it was perhaps a direct genetic link to the rice that's grown in West Africa, and a lot of excitement around it among historians, and they sent some up to be tested at New York University to do some genetic testing on it. And of course, you know, the truth is so limiting sometimes. It turns out that it was not this rice that came directly from Africa, but kind of made its way to Africa from Asian countries. And so it wasn't this African crop. It was, in fact, the Japonica rice, which is not necessarily a terrible thing that it wasn't this indigenous African Blabberima rice is the name of it, but this Japonica rice that went from Southeast Asia to West Africa in probably somewhere the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, still was brought over from Africa by folks who were enslaved, but it was not exactly what they thought it was.
Michael Twitty, the author of The Cooking Gene, wrote about the rice, quote, "It's another living artifact that automatically wipes out any nonsense about the earliest years of African-American food." What did he mean by that?
Well, again, it's that idea that slaves were essentially dumb labor who came over and that Africans somehow had less intelligence or less ability, and they were just captured like cattle, brought over, yoked up, and sent to work. And for a long time, the struggle has been to show that Africans had a lot of agency in their lives and in the kinds of culture they tried to create when they were enslaved and brought over here. And I think there's been academic and social discussion around, and, you know, for obviously, how do you enslave people and keep them down? You convince everybody else that these people are less than. And right. Once we start to discover the food ways and food cultures and the ways that Africans kept their culture alive through food during these long period of enslavement, you start to see the power of that culture. And I think that's what he's trying to get at. So it's this idea of agency, of Africans having agency in their own lives once they were enslaved. And I think that's what he tries to do in his work as well.
You talk about a couple recipes I thought was interesting. My mother actually grew up around Washington and used to make Hoppin' John on New Year's Day, which is rice with black-eyed peas or peas. But there was, you talked about Limpin' Susan, or someone did in that story, which is stir-fried rice with okra. So I'd never heard of Limpin' Susan as a counterpoint to Hoppin' John.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, which is, they say, either the sister or wife of Hoppin' John. It's kind of a drier application. Hoppin' John tends to be a little bit wetter. And that Limpin' Susan is just a little bit closer to the way that the Americans in Trinidad cook this rice, which is often cooked with coconut milk and is a little drier and starchier. And then they take a kind of a chutney from benny seeds or sesame seeds. So they take a chutney that's made with what they call parched benny seeds, or essentially toasted benny seeds. And then often something, an herb called shadow benny, which is a little bit like cilantro, and sprinkle this chutney on top of the kind of starchy, dry, dry rice.
Why do I have a feeling 3 years from now I'll have to stand in line at Whole Foods to buy shadow benny?
You will, sir.
Kim Severson, fabulous story about a lost rice found in Trinidad in South America and part of the Gula culture. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure. You're welcome, Chris.
That was Kim Severson, national food correspondent at the New York Times. Her article is called Finding a Lost Strain of Rice and Clues to Slave Cooking. You can subscribe and listen to Milk Street Radio anytime as a podcast. New shows are available every Friday on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, and Spotify. Just subscribe and get all of our shows downloaded right to your phone or tablet. Right now, my co-host Sarah Moult and I will be taking your call. Sarah is, of course, the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television, also author of the book Home Cooking 101. Sarah, how are you?
I'm great, Chris, and I think it's time to get to the phones.
Open up the lines. Let's go.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who do we have on the line?
Hi, this is Carolyn. I'm from Warwick, Rhode Island.
Oh, hi, Carolyn from Warwick. How can we help you today?
I did have a quick one about your quick cinnamon buns.
Okay.
I made them, and I put them in a little plastic bag, the whole 9-inch pan, not baked, and I froze them. Because I have an event coming up this weekend that I'm baking a lot of things that my mom used to make, and cinnamon buns was something I used to make with yeast. And I did a quickie so that my kids would have this cinnamon buns. Now, will they bake okay when I take them out and thaw them?
Let me ask Chris his opinion here. Chris, this is a cream biscuit dough a la
James Beard. Yeah.
And you roll it out and put the filling in and then roll it up and cut it and put it in. So we've got, it's probably just baking powder. I don't think baking soda, because I don't think there's any acid in
that. It was.
And so I think it will still rise, don't you?
I was wondering if it's like a scone. You can freeze scones in biscuits.
I guess so. I mean,
I think you can.
Baking powder is double acting, which means it acts in the presence of moisture on the first stage and the presence of heat over 120 degrees on the second stage. So you might not get as much lift, but
I think it still works.
So I have to make another batch, and I didn't know whether to do the same thing.
You know, I've gotten frozen biscuits from my favorite place in Charleston, Callie's Biscuits. I don't know if you've ever had them. And they're raw.
No.
And they puff up beautifully.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to work.
The only thing is you might next time double the
put a little more
baking powder, in.
Or one and a half, because we know baking powder adds that taste that you sort of don't want to be too overwhelming. But I'd love it if you get back to us and let us know how it went.
Yeah, because I have to make a lot of things, and I freeze a lot before I bake it. That way it's fresh.
Yeah, no, I love that.
Go to serve.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it was nice and sticky on the bottom.
Yeah.
All that yummy honey, but I've got to tell you something. don't ever leave the pan on the stove when you're doing that.
Oh, dear.
And walk away.
Oh, dear. No, no, of course not. No, this could be a problem.
I know it was. So I had to make the sticky all over again, and the house was filled with smoke. But other than that.
At least you don't live in New York City where the alarm would have gone off.
Right. So, and yet nobody would have cared.
Yeah, not in Warwick.
Carolyn, thank you so much for calling.
Okay.
You're welcome. Yeah. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milkshake Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you have a cooking failure or a question, give us a call anytime. Our number is 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or please send us an email anytime at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Hello, welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Mark Gatza, and I'm calling from Bel Air, Maryland, in the upper corner of the state.
How can we help you?
I have some questions about vinegar. I use a lot of vinegar. I make pickles. I make hot and sour soup and gazpacho, and I have about maybe 10 different kinds. I went to get a bottle of cider vinegar for barbecue season and discovered that all the shelves had changed in the supermarket. Where I used to find the cider vinegar, there was now cider vinegar with mother. I know that mother is what they use to make vinegar, but I'm wondering why that's now at eye level and everything else has been displaced. And I'm wondering what I can do with the mother in the vinegar.
I'm going to defer to Chris because he actually makes vinegar from scratch. Chris?
Oh, well, you can make vinegar by buying Bragg's apple cider vinegar, which is unpasteurized, I believe.
I have seen that, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You can use that, like 6 parts wine, 1 part Bragg's, throw it in a crock with some cheesecloth on it and let it sit for about a month and then keep filling it up as it evaporates. And that will turn into vinegar, which I've done. It's the easiest recipe in the world, and I have a huge crock of vinegar. So Bragg's unprocessed, the unpasteurized vinegar is...
Unfiltered, unprocessed.
Yes.
Yeah. The idea being that it has the natural bacteria
yes.
in it. Let's say what the mother is. It's that cellulose layer that forms when that whole process is going on, and it floats in the vinegar.
You get a little bit on top, yeah.
I think there's a perception that it's like kombucha, you know, all those fermented foods, that fermented foods are good for you.
Right. I did look that up, and I saw some lists of the benefits of having a little bit of vinegar with mother every day. I'm thinking a glass of red wine probably does the same thing, but that would be my opinion.
I'm with you.
I vote for the red wine. We're the red wine team over here. We're right there with you.
Exactly. Now, the next question is, I learned from you all about pomegranate molasses.
Yep.
And I love that flavor, and I use it a lot. And I'm wondering, is it possible to take the mother from, you know, a cider vinegar and somehow mix it up with the molasses to make pomegranate vinegar itself?
I wonder why you wouldn't just take fresh pomegranate juice. Because you can turn any sweet beverage into a vinegar by adding a mother or a starter. And you can order starters from wine companies, too, because they'll give you a starter just like, you know, you use for wine, you use for vinegar. But I would take fresh pomegranate juice because pomegranate molasses is already so reduced and so thick. I would start with the fresh juice and get a starter or maybe even add a little bit of Bragg's.
Okay.
Or just suck down the pomegranate molasses, which is like my favorite thing in the world. Can I just ask a question? So how do you use pomegranate molasses at home?
Oh, I throw a little in whenever I make an Asian sauce. Mm-hmm. I also do a lot of Middle Eastern sauces for kebabs and things like
yep.
that. I have thrown it into vinaigrettes. We make
yes,
all of our own
I do that
salad
too.
Dressings.
Yeah. A little bit at the end of a meat stew,
mm-hmm.
like a capful, makes a big difference too.
You know, it's a nice double whammy. It's both sweet and tangy, sort of like tamarind.
Yeah, it's very much like tamarind. It's a little sweeter.
Very
like
nice
tamarind.
Ingredient.
Good for you.
Well, you're a serious
yeah.
cook. Wow.
Well, 35 years in my household, I have been in charge of the kitchen. And the good thing is that when you're in charge of the kitchen, you always get what you want for dinner.
Good point. I like that.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate
yeah.
it. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Coming up next, my conversation with Edward Lee, author of the book Buttermilk Graffiti. We'll be right back. You know, wonderful pistachios have become my go-to snack. Now, I could list all the health benefits. They're a good source of protein, fiber, and unsaturated fats. But for me, flavor comes first, and that's why it's pistachios, not peanuts, in our household. Wonderful pistachios come in a variety of flavors and sizes, including sea salt and vinegar, chili roasted, and smoke barbecue. Check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more. That's wonderfulpistachios.com. This is Most Jet Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Edward Lee is a chef, a traveler, and an accomplished writer. For 2 years, Lee traveled across America looking for overlooked pockets of immigrant cooking and the people who cooked it. He published his stories and recipes in his new book, Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. Let's start with a quote from your book. Authenticity is a word I rarely use and one I never give credence to. Tradition, though, is used to describe nostalgia. It is a sister to authenticity and yet wholly different. What did you mean by that?
So I go on a rant a lot about when people call things authentic, and to me the word authentic is really just one person's truth versus another, and there is only one authenticity, right? When we say something's authentic, it usually means there's only one answer. But traditions are endless. Traditions are you know, go on forever, and there can be multiple traditions. And I truly believe that when we talk about food, that's what we're talking about, traditions. When we talk about something being authentic, we're talking about it really meaning that there's a tradition behind it that touches your heart or touches your nostalgia. But there's no one real recipe. There's no one truth to any cuisine. I think there's infinite varieties of tradition.
So you should describe the concept of the book. You travel around the country looking for what?
I traveled around the country looking for my definition, and I say my definition because it's a very personal journey, but it's my definition of what American food is in this time that we live in right now. And that food is colored by immigrants, both new and people who have been here for generations and centuries. And that ongoing saga of people who come to this country and try to preserve something that they had from the motherland, some culinary tradition that they had, at the same time trying to sort of find their identity in this new foreign place that they're in.
So you go to these restaurants. One of the things I noticed is your ability to eat. As you say, you get your head down, you sweat, and you don't look up for an hour. You just eat. But you might go through 10 or 15 items on a menu. You are a prodigious eater, unless you just take tiny bites.
I do both. I am a prodigious eater, but there are some things that obviously I can't finish the whole plate. But, you know, people who don't know me very well, who have actually witnessed me eat, are become very shocked about this. I don't do this for sport, you know, and I make jest of it, but I'm really absorbing information. And to me, sometimes like you eat it, like take for example this Cambodian dish with the fish and the turmeric and the coconut milk and the ginger. I could take two bites and let it go and just record the flavors. But a dish like that, it kind of changes in your mouth. It's almost like the first few bites are your mouth just gets acclimated, you know, towards these really aggressive flavors. And really, you know, eight bites into it, it's kind of a different dish than it was. And after two bites.
Let's talk about some of the people and places people you met and places you went. Norman Van Aken, I met him a long time ago. I think you were in Florida, is that correct, when you met him?
Yes.
And you said that he coined the term fusion back in the 80s. So you want to tell that story?
Yeah, so it's funny. So because of, you know, the cuisine that I cook, which is kind of a blend of Southern and Asian food, you know, I've been surrounded both professionally and personally by this word fusion my whole life. And I've always hated the word. I've always felt like the word didn't really have a place, because if we're talking about two things culturally that combine to come up with a third thing, well, all food is fusion, right? And everything that we do is a combination of different cultural influences. And so I kind of went back and studied the word and figured out where it came from. And like most things, you know, it was sort of a misrepresentation of what Norman Van Aken was talking about. And his fusion that he was talking about was really not two different ethnicities, but it was the fusion of high cuisine and low cuisine. And by that he meant, you know, this idea of the French brigade system and fusing that with the flavors and spices and cooking techniques of, you know, the immigrants of Miami during the day when he was cooking, which was mostly Cuban and, you know, West African, Caribbean food. And so that, to me, when I discovered that, what he was truly getting at, it was like a revelation. And back when I was a young chef, you know, there weren't a lot of people doing that.
You write about the West Virginia hot dog, sometimes referred to as Skeeters. So this is chili on a hot dog, among other things.
Yes.
The structure of the chili is critical because if it's too tight, it doesn't collapse in your mouth with the other ingredients. Too loose and the chili dog falls apart. Really? I mean, is it really that specific? I mean, or are you overriding here?
It's a chili dog. It is true because chili can be a very, you know, it can be almost a paste-like structure.
Right.
Which doesn't work, but it can also be soup.
And then you also ran across pepperoni rolls, which I guess were often used by miners for lunch, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I just ran into someone recently who had not read the book, but is from Appalachia. And she said, why'd you write about the pepperoni roll? It's disgusting. And I said, you know, I think the pepperoni roll is a really pure example of this very utilitarian food. It's very bland. There's nothing spectacular about it. But not every meal has to be this explosion of flavor that's going to rock our world. Like sometimes food can just be pleasant and utilitarian and nostalgic.
And didn't you buy a bunch of them and kept giving them out to people?
Yes, I did.
So Edward did. Lee, right?
Because I didn't want to eat them all.
Nice to meet you. Here's an extra pepperoni roll. let's talk about the talk. The talk is when you sat down with your dad and said you wanted to be a cook. How did that go?
Oh, yeah. That didn't go over very well. I am of a certain generation. You know, I'm in my mid-40s, and I find that every chef that I know that's around my age or older, I always ask them, what happened when you told your parents you wanted to be a chef? And most chefs, they all have a very similar reaction, which is, you know, pretty much aghast, you know, someone sighing, someone, you know, slapping their forehead and saying, oh, man, you know, like it wasn't a popular career choice, you know, in those days. And my father particularly, you know, we were immigrants, right? I was the first born son in America. I was supposed to be the one that becomes the lawyer or the accountant and, you know, or a doctor and sort of, you know, has a quote-unquote respectable job. And here I go becoming a chef. And I remember my dad saying to me, we didn't bring you to this country so you could be a servant. You know, we brought you here so you could succeed. And now, granted, there were no such things as celebrity chefs in Korea. So to him, the idea of being a chef was just being a subservient cook. Which also he was right in because I spent many years just being a subservient cook.
Yeah.
And I still am. But also, you know, there was something about this profession that I just knew I was going to do.
So you also mentioned something historically that after the Korean War, it was a very difficult time. And you say people didn't want to talk about or remember how families were pitted against each other for what little there was to be had. So it's a very difficult period in history back then. You want to just quickly elaborate on that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. With Koreans, you know, it's part of this writing of this book, you know, the idea of authenticity, the idea of truth, the idea of sort of unmasking cultural truths about different cuisines. There's a lot of things that are misperceived about food, about cultures. You know, Koreans are always, you know, depicted as being very gritty, hardworking, very, you know, nose to the bone, work all day, and they're very feisty and cutthroat. And I guess we are as a people. Part of it is when you sort of have an entire generation that grows out of a war and has to bring up a family with very, very limited supplies. Guess what? You, as an entire, as a people, you will become cutthroat and gritty and you know, hardworking, and it's something that is still a remnant of the Korean War. It's something that I saw in my parents. It's something that I see in myself, both good and bad. Also, I think you can see it in the food. It's hard to describe the food of a nation without also talking about sort of the politics and the war and the economics and everything else that happens to a people.
So you find that odd places like Paterson, New Jersey, has the largest concentration of Peruvian restaurants in the country, for example. How did that come to be, and what did you find when you went there?
You know, Peruvian food is something that I am admittedly, I know very little about, and I knew even less when I was researching the chapter. And I went there thinking I would find something of you know, Peruvian food. And I wound up finding this incredible, almost forgotten city that is, you know, if you live in New York City, if you live in Manhattan, it's on a good day without traffic, it's a 20-minute ride. And this historic city that's had so many layers of immigration, so many generations of turnover, and this being the latest incarnation of it.
You talk, actually, there's another great quote. And this is a recurring theme in your book. You have someone who emigrated from Peru when he was young. He's now cooking.
Yes.
And you say, quote, "In an odd twist of history, the Lima of Ricardo's youth now lives here in Paterson." In other words, what he's cooking is the cooking of 30 or 40 years ago in his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And Lima's moved on, of course.
Yeah.
And he hasn't, because he's nostalgic for that food, which gets back to the issue of, you know, how do you define authentic, right?
Right. Someone asked me the other day, you know, what's the book about? And I said, it's a romance book.
You know,
it should be in the romance category. And because really, to me, like, isn't all of food nostalgia? And what I find fascinating is that those romantic notions of what flavor is, when you look at the landscape of immigrant culture and food in America, it comes from 100 different cultures, 100 different countries, and they all land here, and they all kind of rub up against each other. And then some kind of start to, like, blend, and some kind of influence each other, and some kind of make changes and adjustments. And lo and behold, what you have is this beautiful mix of flavors and aromas, and none of it is authentic. None of it is authentic to the food that was cooked in the homeland.
You love Café du Monde in New Orleans. You love the beignet. But you said there was a cousin to the beignet, C-A-L-A-S. What is that?
It's a similar fried dough, but made with rice flour, and it's called kala. Versus the refined wheat flour that obviously we use with beignets. The origins come from West Africa. But that, you know, once refined flour was introduced and it became popular, you know, the rice flour version just kind of disappeared.
And did you get it there, or where did you taste it?
There are some historic cookbooks that have recipes for it, and I've made them myself. But it's an interesting thing that recipes, like dinosaurs, can go extinct.
Jack Brady, you ran into this boxer from Lowell, Massachusetts, right? Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And you say his finger retains the muscle memory of violence, which I like. So how did you run into this guy, and what was he like?
So I went to Lowell to study. I was doing a story on Cambodian food, and I met this wonderful Cambodian chef, and we're eating and talking. And one afternoon, I drive by Romalo's West End Gym, and it had a huge, you know, Irish flag. And of course, I've, you know, a Lowell is the history of Irish immigration is so important in Lowell. So I walk in there and I talk to a couple of trainers, and they said, "Listen, if you really want some great stories about Lowell, you got to talk to this guy, Irish Jack Brady, and you'll find him at this bar." So I go to this bar, and he's not there, and I give him my number, and they say, Jack Brady doesn't use telephones. So if you want to talk to him, you have to come back. And I said, fine. So I come back later, and I find him at the bar. And you know, next thing you know, we're drinking Irish whiskey and talking till 2 in the morning. And he's just telling me about, you know, the history of Irish immigration and the history of Lowell, and story after story about growing up in sort of the ghettos of Lowell with the poor Irish who are just, you know, struggling and scraping to get ahead. And it reminded me so much, right, of what my family did or what the new immigrants are doing, and this passing of the torch, right, between the older immigration and the newer immigrants who come in, and they do the exact same thing. It's just a different time, a different generation, different jobs, but they do. They come in and they do all the jobs that no one wants to do. And it was in that moment, this foggy haze at 2 a.m, that I realized that I can't write about the Cambodian chef in Lowell and not talk about the Irish boxer, because they're linked. They're linked together. Even though the Irish boxer will probably not go to the Cambodian restaurant, and the Cambodian chef is not going to go drinking in the Irish bar, but they're linked to, you know, in some odd way.
Edward Lee, it's been an enormous pleasure. Your book is fabulous, Buttermilk Graffiti. Extremely well-written, fascinating stories. And I wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And I've been reading and following you for so many years, so it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
That was Chef Edward Lee. His new book is called Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. You know, Edward Lee has resolved a literary question that lingers in the food world. Is food writing its own discipline, or is it just writing? You know, many food writers throw around adjectives like M&Ms, basil-flecked, herbaceous, delectable, and zesty. But Edward Lee treats food writing like what it is, writing. Here he describes the first taste of lamb broth, quote, "It is the taste of a wet forest. It is a flavor that starts in the nostrils and slides down like heavy rain." Take that, Ernest Hemingway. Right now, I'm heading into the kitchen at Milk Street to chat with Lynn Clark about this week's recipe, escalivada. Lynn, how are you?
I'm great, Chris.
So vegetables on the grill are always an afterthought, except in Spain, where they have a history and tradition of cooking vegetables actually on the coals because they want to get some nice char on the outside and a lot of smoky flavor. So let's take that concept of getting smoky, almost charred vegetables on the outside off of a backyard barbecue grill.
Right. So usually when we cook vegetables, especially on the grill, we kind of treat them very delicately. What we're going to do here is sort of flip the script on them and treat them like the meat we would also probably be grilling at the same time that we're cooking the vegetables. So we're going to create a two-level grill. One side is going to be very hot. It's going to be over high heat. The other side is going to be off. That's going to allow us to get a lot of char on the vegetables, but then move them to the cooler side of the grill so that they can fully cook through and get nice and tender. That's how we cook a steak, and so we're going to do the same thing with our vegetables.
And what vegetables are we using?
So we're using eggplant, and you want to use Japanese eggplant here. They typically use a globe eggplant, but we found a Japanese eggplant is smaller, so it's going to cook faster, thinner skin, so you don't have to peel it, less prep. Red bell pepper, onion two ways, red onion cut into wedges, and scallions. Those all get tossed with olive oil, sweet or hot paprika and salt and pepper. That sits while the grill is heating, so it gets some nice flavor on it. And the big thing here is you don't want to be worried about getting them too dark. You really want that char on the vegetables, nice smoky, smoky flavor. They come off the heat, we chop them up into bite-sized pieces. While we love that char, it did need a little bit of balance, so we added some cherry tomatoes, sherry vinegar, garlic, and honey. So we balance that out with a little bit of sweetness and acidity, and it really goes nicely with a lot of that smoky char we got off the vegetables.
So I can burn my vegetables, and I'm doing it right.
Exactly.
This is the perfect recipe for me. Thank you, Lynn. This is a great way to grill your vegetables in the summer. This is escalivada, which comes from Spain, of course, which is smoky grilled vegetables. Thank you.
You're welcome. You can get this recipe at 177milkstreet.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Coming up, more of your culinary questions and dilemmas. My co-host, Sarah Moulton. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Now it's time to hear from our listeners with my co-host Sarah Moulton. Sarah, are you ready to go?
I am ready to take those questions.
Welcome to Mill Street. Who's calling?
This is Rebecca from Merced, California.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. How can we help you?
So I am a big fan of making ice cream from scratch, and I don't know if you've had a lot of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, but...
He's from Vermont, remember, partially from Vermont, yeah.
Yeah, no, I figured. They do some kind of ice creams where it's like a cookie dough swirl, or one of my favorites is like a cinnamon bun kind of swirl. And I was trying to recreate that, but because it's a dough, I wasn't sure how to convert that into a swirl.
Well, I think one of the things is you don't want it to freeze hard. You want it to stay soft, right?
Well, you want to take the eggs out.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have uncooked eggs. So definitely drop the eggs in the cookie recipe.
Okay. And I tried doing like an edible cookie dough, and in the fridge, I just left it, you know, to as a kind of make ahead kind of thing, and it was just completely hard in the fridge, so I didn't know how to do that.
You know, a lot of times what people add to soften is like a syrup, like corn syrup or golden syrup. Which keeps things soft. And Chris is right, also lose the eggs.
Well, you know, there's a book. Is it out yet, or it's coming out? Brave Tart.
Oh, it's out.
It's out.
It's a really fun book.
I just interviewed her a couple of weeks ago. And she's got terrific recipes. But I think she has an ice cream with a cookie dough in it. So you might want to check that out. And her stuff's pretty good.
That's a book worth getting anyway, I think.
And that's on. She's the resident baker at Serious Eats.
And she's sort of the answer girl when it comes to science about baking.
I would go online to Serious Eats and see if they have that recipe. Or I would actually ask her that question.
Yeah. Or go to your library.
Brave Tart?
Brave Tart. Yeah, and also corn syrup does sound like the right answer to me.
Yeah, because that would keep it soft,
but
which is what you need.
She's also really into the chemistry and science of baking. She'd be a good person to ask.
Okay. All right. Sounds good.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
You're listening to Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Give us a call anytime with your questions at 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843, or send us an email at questions@millstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Simon from McLean, Virginia.
Hi, Simon. How can we help you today?
Sure. I was rummaging through the basement and I found probably an old Mother's Day gift, a tagine. I was curious how braising a tagine differs from braising it in, say, an enameled Dutch oven. Is this a case of just the vessel that was devised in that region, or is it designed to perform and deliver different results than than the Western Dutch oven?
Excellent question.
Yeah.
There are two things. It's, you know, it's terracotta, it's pottery. And so my guess is the heat level as you cook with it is probably going to be moderate, low to moderate. So it's probably lower cooking than what you'll do on top of the stove. And then the theory is that the steam collects at the top and then condenses and drips down. But that has absolutely nothing to do with what's going on inside the chicken or the lamb or anything else, because exterior liquid doesn't flow into the meat. The juiciness is dependent upon the internal temperature. So to make a long story short, no, you can cook in a Dutch oven just fine. Don't do it on top of the stove. Do it in a very low oven. And I do it all the time. And you'll get, I think, the same results. I've cooked with a tagine too, which I love. And a lot of people love cooking with terracotta, which I think is a gentler way of cooking. But you can mimic that in a low oven, I think.
Yeah, so you're saying if you did use a Dutch oven, don't do it on top of the stove. Do it in the oven.
Yeah, the top of the stove is a problem because the heat's
one
coming from the bottom.
Yeah.
It's not even, and it's very hard to adjust most stovetops to a very low setting. For years, I've had a stovetop, which I love, except when I get to a low simmer, it sort of goes out. I can't get it low enough. You know?
Yeah.
So a low oven is the way to go. So no, you don't need a tagine.
But since he has one, he might as well use it.
It's lovely, and I've been in Morocco and cooked with a chef using tagine. It's delicious, but I think it's just because it's very, very moderate heat.
Yeah,
yeah,
consistent.
And the design, I don't think, really has anything to do with the interior of the meat itself.
But you do end up with a nice bunch of juice when you're done.
Yeah, which you would sauce. In a Dutch oven.
You would, too. Yeah.
The one thing I did learn about tagines, though, is that in Morocco, they don't really saute anything to start. They might cook the onions for 3 or 4 minutes in some oil, but then they add, let's say, the chicken and the preserved lemon and the olives and the ginger, et cetera. And so when they're done, a couple hours later, every single ingredient is still there. It's not melting pot. Everything retains its original flavor. And I think that's the secret of a good tagine, is you still taste every single ingredient that went in, unlike a beef bourguignon, which is all umami.
One, yeah.
Right.
And that's
right.
Why they're so delicious. And that's very low heat and making sure each of those ingredients doesn't get turned into one flavor.
So if you were to use it, you would use it on the stovetop?
Yeah, it's designed to be used on a stovetop, but I just use very low heat. And the terracotta will also ameliorate the heat too.
It'll
like
distribute
metal.
Better than...
Distribute better, it'll take more time to heat up, but it'll be very gentle, which is good.
Which is good, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I would use it. Go ahead and use it.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
This is Milkshake Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you have a cooking failure or a question, give us a call anytime. Our number is 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or please send us an email anytime at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Right now it's time for this week's Milk Street Basic. Sometimes you need a pan on the grill to contain vegetables that might otherwise fall through grill grates, or to make quick sauces, or even to hold resting steaks, chops, or chicken parts. The easy solution is cheap pie plates, which are large and flat enough to hold a fair amount and have just enough of a lip to contain liquids. So our suggestion is to buy a pair of cheap metal 9-inch plates. By the way, make sure they're not non-stick. The coating will burn off on the grill. And don't use them for making pie afterwards unless you're looking to add a smoky flavor to your crust. For more information, please go to milkstreetradio.com. So what's the difference between kosher salt and table salt? J. Kenji Lopez-Alt is here to answer. Kenji, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
So what are we talking about today?
I think we're talking about salt.
Okay.
Our recipes on Serious Eats and in my book, and I think probably in Milk Street too, often call for kosher salt. In fact, they almost exclusively call for kosher salt. And so people ask, why do I need kosher salt? Or when should I use table salt? When should I use kosher? When should I use one of these fancy sea salts? So that's the real question. Why do recipes call for kosher salt? The main thing to know, first of all, is that almost all the salt you're going to buy at the supermarket is pretty much chemically identical, whether it's table salt or kosher salt or even one of those fancy sea salts. They're 99.999% sodium chloride.
Right.
Table salt often has iodine added to it. It's because in the 20s, people used to get goiter from a lack of iodine. That's not really a problem these days, at least in most of the U.S. Kosher salt is pretty much pure sodium chloride, and most sea salts are sodium chloride mixed with sort of trace mineral elements that will slightly affect the flavor, but mostly just affect the way they look.
Now, I talked to a quote-unquote salt expert, spice expert. He said gray sea salt is the one kind of salt that actually does have more flavor. Do you agree with that or not?
I mean, to a very finely tuned palate, perhaps. I think most people are not really going to notice a flavor difference, though. The real difference you're going to notice in those types of salts is the texture. Right. And, you know, and that's why chefs use sort of those fancy sea salts, because depending on how the salt crystals were formed, you know, whether they were harvested from the top of a salt pond or whether they condense and form clumps on the bottom or whether they're pulled out of a mine, the way in which the salt crystals are formed can produce different shapes. So, like, Maldon sea salt from England has these nice sort of flaky pyramids. Fleur de Sel, the gray sea salt from France, forms these sort of moist clumps. And so really the reason you use those salts is for texture, because they don't sort of melt as quickly as other salts. So you get these kind of bursts of salinity.
So this means really using a coarse salt on top of food before you serve it.
Exactly.
So you would never put it into a stew or a soup or pasta.
No, I mean,
water.
Doing that, I mean, you're basically, that's basically like, you know, replacing your toilet paper with dollar bills. Like, it doesn't really make it. It doesn't really make, you're just
what
flushing.
A great analogy. Thank you. I'll think about
you're
that.
You're just kind of flushing it down the toilet at that, all the good qualities down the toilet at that point. So the question really then is, why kosher salt versus table salt? And there's a few things to consider. One of them is relative density. Kosher salt doesn't pack as easily. So fine table salt is very small cubes. It's essentially, if you look at it under a microscope, or even with your naked eye, you can almost see it, that they're almost perfect cubes. They stack very easily. They pack very nicely into containers. And so they end up being quite dense, whereas kosher salts are sort of these jagged flakes. So it's sort of like if you have an aquarium, you know, and you fill it up with halfway with small bits of gravel, you're going to pack in a lot more rock there than if you just put a single large stone in there and you can't really fit anything else. There's a lot more empty space there. So kosher salt tends to be less dense than table salt, which means that if a recipe calls for table salt, volume-wise, you're going to use more
Except
kosher salt.
We've actually tested this, and Diamond Crystal kosher salt is about 1.5 times in volume.
Right.
So in other words, you'd have to use, for a teaspoon of table salt, you need 1.5 to 2 teaspoons of Diamond Crystal.
Right.
But Morton's kosher salt is just slightly more than table salt.
Right.
So it depends on brand.
It does, which is why you kind of have to stick to a brand. And which is why, you know, in recipes, I often call for Diamond Crystal kosher salt, and people think that, their Diamond Crystal is paying you to say this. It's because I tested this recipe with Diamond Crystal, and if you use another salt, you're going to have to convert it. The main reason that chefs use kosher salt has nothing to do with the density or the flavor. It's because it's easy to pick up and it's easy to measure. So the main reason to use kosher salt is because it's easier to sprinkle evenly over your food.
And so you use, like I do, a salt box or cellar,
yes.
Right? Which is just a container of coarse salt near your stove, probably.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a container with a little lid. But yeah, to me, that's one of the most essential pieces of kitchen gear, because first of all, it's a constant reminder that you should be seasoning your food as you go. Salt is essential for bringing out the flavors of other foods. It's essential for sort of taming bitterness. It brings out the sweetness of vegetables. It brings out the meatiness of meat. It's an essential ingredient in almost any cuisine. So having that salt cellar there is sort of a way to mentally make sure that you're always thinking about the seasoning level in your food.
And now let's answer the question every listener wants to ask right now, which is, what about Himalayan salt, Hawaiian sea salt, pink salt? Salts, all the different colors, they're very expensive. Your answer is, doesn't matter?
Well, you know, they're nice. They look nice. They can add texture to your food. You definitely don't want to be cooking with those salts. You don't want to add them to soups or anything like that, because all those qualities are going to go away. But, you know, I do have a collection of salts at home, and I put them on the table when I'm eating, and I like to do things that have textural contrast or color contrast. I think a black sea salt looks really nice against meat. Maldon flakes look really nice. And all those things obviously factor into how we enjoy our food. You know, fancy sea salts, they're definitely not essential. And if you're eating with your eyes closed and you're just sitting in a dark room, they're probably not going to have that much of an effect. But nobody eats with their eyes closed.
So now we've learned that Kenji's not just a scientist, he's an artist. He listens to Beethoven while he eats, and he has some pink salts on the table just because it makes him feel good. Kenji, you're a man of many interests. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. He's the author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, also the chief culinary advisor for Serious Eats. Earlier in the show, I chatted with Kim Severson about the search for a lost strain of West African rice. Kim is a reporter for The New York Times, an institution that subscribes to the value of facts. Food is about many things: taste, history, culture, nourishment, and of course, facts. The facts about food science, for example. Reporters like Severson are finally reporting the little-known facts about culinary history. And once we have the facts, we can tell true stories about who we are and where we come from. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late, you can listen to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts. Please remember to subscribe to the show. You'll automatically get every single show downloaded to your phone or tablet each week. If you want to learn more about Milk Street, please head to 177milkstreet.com. There you can download each week's recipe, subscribe to our magazine, watch our TV show, or order our new cookbook. We'll be back next week, and thanks for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison. Producer Annie Sinzabaugh. Production assistant Jackie Nowak and production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer Douglas Sugarts. Additional editing from Vicky Merrick and Sydney Lewis and audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Chubop Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.